take a stroll through the streets of Paris and you'll see lines of people making their daily pilgrimage for that morning baguette. There are some 1,200 boulangeries in Paris alone, and four simple ingredients: wheat, yeast, water, and salt. That makes baguettes. And yet, here in Paris, the baguette represents so much: culture, history, nourishment. It's the staff of Parisian life. Can it be true that 94% of all Parisians live less than 5 minutes from a bakery? I'm here to find out. I'm Jonathan Green. This is Return Ticket, the podcast that takes you on journeys of the mind to the near and the far flung. In coming episodes, I'll ask the critical question: is Tasmania terrible? We'll test the odds in Las Vegas and sync with the rhythms of Ho Chi Minh City. But right now, this is Paris by Baguette.
Bonjour.
Ah, bonjour, my good fellow. Avez-vous le stick de pain avec le soy latte?
Pardon.
I'm Stephen Kaplan, historian, expert on bread, critic of bread, a passionate lover of bread.
This then is a perfect coincidence that we should meet.
If you want to ask for a baguette, that's good, but the crucial thing, if you're interested in what we call the sensorial domain, that is to say, the hedonic aspect of eating bread,
yes,
and you want to talk about a baguette, you want always to ask for a baguette de tradition and not a generic baguette, because the generic baguette is dead on arrival, whereas the baguette de tradition is full of vitality. It's charged with all sorts of aroma. It's quite sumptuous to the touch and to the view, and it is absolutely spellbinding in your mouth.
This baguette here in our hands, how would we judge this? What are the criteria by which you would assess that piece of bread?
So the first thing is aspect or look. If it's not minimally seductive, if it doesn't provoke a certain concupiscence, as it were, you're not going to want to go any further. And since bread solicits all of our senses simultaneously, we touch it, we feel it, we put it to our nose, we put it to our face, we have it in our fingertips. So to want to caress it, to want to eat it, to want to taste it, it has to look reasonably good. Second criterion, crust. I want to feel a crust that makes noise, that sings a song, that when I squeeze it, it's going to have an audible reaction. It's going to have a crackling sound. I want it to be brownish gold. I want it to be baked properly. There's a tendency in France today to go towards what is soft. People are lazy. They don't want it too. The third criterion is crumb. I want a crumb that's sensual. I want a crumb that is inscribed with cavities of different sizes in a kind of savage, unequal way. I use words, obviously, that are charged with sexual metaphors, because bread is giving birth, as it were. Bread is in the form of the dough, is alive, and you seed the bread with an agent of fermentation. You watch it expand. It's a kind of process that is into gestation, as it were, to giving birth. Fourth, mouthfeel. We call it in French mâche, which is a better term. Mouthfeel is the first impression in your mouth, the first attack, as it were. It should not be aggressive. It should elicit the saliva in your mouth. It should give you a first premise of something quite pleasant. And then there are what I call the royal categories. Aroma: when I open up a baguette, I section vertically so as not to lacerate the crumb. I put it up to my nose immediately. I deeply inhale. I want to have a sort of vertiginous sense of imminent pleasure. I want it to be moving. I want it to be touching, because bread consumption ultimately is an emotional experience. If the aroma is promising, I go on to putting it in my mouth and tasting it, and I hope that the taste will confirm the aroma. So those are my criteria. I'll let you go on.
I said again so that you're setting yourself up for constant disappointment.
or deferred gratification. The next shop will do better. The next bread will do
better. Well, this is the initial statistic which caught our eye in this investigation of bread in Paris is the frequency with which one comes upon a baker. Despite the quality of their offering, nonetheless, the baking of bread and the proximity of your habitation to the source of your bread is a fundamental thing in Parisian culture.
It is in Parisian culture. If you look more broadly throughout France, you see that in 1950, there were 56, 57,000 bakers. There are probably 31, 32,000 today. So I think that the habits of consumption are gradually changing. But it's true that intramural Paris has about 1,200 bakeries. That's a lot of bakeries. In 1900, we were eating 550, 600 grams per person. But we're now around 80 grams per person. I think bread has lost its lure. It's certainly its passion for most French. They buy it in a kind of mechanical way. They use it to push their sauce, because otherwise, how can they eat such an awful bread day after day?
To take us back to the 18th century, to look for the sources of regulation and the prescribing of the nature of bread, other aspects of the culture that date back to that moment, where would I investigate that in this city? How can I dip into this moment of Parisian time?
Until relatively recently, bread was a matter of survival. In France, even during the Second World War, in 1947, after the war, the Germans are kicked out. The French have reclaimed their autonomy. France is reconstructing after devastation. But there are riots in 1947 because France is starving, because there's not enough food. And you look just at these riots, as I do, and you say to yourself, Jesus, I'm back in 1747, 1947, because we see the same kind of phenomena. As soon as we get beyond the 10 years of penury after the end of the Second World War, and we return to a society that is, in fact, a rich society, there you have a diversified diet, you have a social structure that's quite diverse, but you have fewer and fewer people who are really on the margin, who are really poor. So bread occupies a very small place in the food-buying basket. The French state continued to fix the price of bread until the end of 1986. In 1986, that is to say, by a kind of tropism of sort of historical continuity, by the sort of desire of the nourishing prince who was once the king and is now the president to reassure the people that he is always there to guide them and to guarantee them against famine, against starvation. The price of bread was fixed literally until the end of 1986. That's astonishing because bread was just not that important anymore. You know, you talk about entrenched habit. The habits were habits of dependence until quite recently. And now there was a shift. And this is a shift the bakers didn't understand. It was a shift from bread as necessity to bread as pleasure.
Yes.
And I think psychologically, the bakers believed that there was a kind of eternal subscription that was purchased by all the French, that they would go on forever eating bread. And so the French bakers didn't have to worry about quality, didn't have to worry about seducing the clients, that people would buy bread the way they brush their teeth. It's simply something you do. A lot of bakers are struggling vis-a-vis this concentration in chains, vis-a-vis industrial bread. Now, industrial bread was really shitty. It was really very, very bad for a long time. Now, there is some very good industrial bread. Some of it is indistinguishable in many ways from second-rate artisanal bread. Artisanal bakers are really on the defensive and are trying every ploy, every possibility to try and distinguish themselves. And it seems that using every device, every lever, except that of taste and aroma. And I think that's a mistake.
Thank you so much for helping me out there.
It's been a pleasure.
Taxi!
Bonjour.
I wonder if you could take me to my friend Alice Cabaret's place.
Welcome. En gauche, en droite.
I've got it written down here on a piece of paper. Here.
That's the point. No, I get what I'm saying.
Yes, well, thank you. We're on our way.
Here's your baguette. No, I get what I'm saying. You cannot. No, no, no.
Oh, that was quick. Are we here? You're going to park. All right, if you can do that while eating that baguette, I'll be impressed. Oh! 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 Oh, well done. Here we are then. In order to test the theory that 94% of Parisians live less than 5 minutes from a bakery, I need to explore the Paris grid. It's part of what makes this city so distinct, these wide boulevards. They map Parisian life. Broad, tree-lined streets crisscrossing the city, studded with, yes, bustling boulangeries. The balance of Parisian life tips towards the street. The legal minimum size of an apartment in Paris is just 9 square meters, so it's no wonder that so much of life here takes place outside of the home. All right, so I'm off to the next bakery on my list. That's a long one. Mamiche. Now, that's just near my friend Alice Cabaret's place. She's a French urban strategist, director of the Street Society in Paris.
Bonjour, Jonathan.
Alice, hello. What a beautiful local boulangerie you have here.
Yes, welcome to Mamiche. It's actually a great example of a modern, you know, creative bakery in Paris.
What are we going to have?
I don't know. What about pain au chocolat?
Okay, I'm in for that.
Okay, bonjour. Je voudrais deux pains au chocolat, s'il vous plaît.
This pain au chocolat, we're going to have that. The name itself, isn't that part of a sort of national debate?
Yes, actually, pain au chocolat, they're also called chocolatine in the southwest of France. Yes, there are regular debates about that, and the topic was even brought up in Parliament a few years ago.
Wow.
But you can call it whatever you like, Jonathan.
See, many of us, when we think of Paris, we think of the old city there, the Baron Haussmann city, that regulated, tightly defined architecture that gives so much of Paris its character.
Yes, you're right. You know, Haussmann did have a radical impact on the Parisian landscape. Today, the city is really different. We have to adapt the city to contemporary users and to climate change. So this involved completely rethinking the way we live, the way we commute, the way we share spaces in the city.
Is there any resistance to that sort of adaptation of the city from traditionalists?
Well, I would say in Paris, there's always a fine line, and we have to find this balance between heritage preservation and protecting the history of Paris and its beautiful and mixed identity, as well as opening up to contemporary users and make it more resilient and make the city, you know, still a living city, not a museum city. I thought we could enjoy the sunrise from Montmartre Hill with a bird's eye view of the city.
Now, Alice, our journey to Montmartre, it could be said it begins with a single step.
Well, it starts with a single step, but are you ready actually for the 222 steps leading
222?
Up to the top? Yes, come on, let's go, Jonathan.
Oh, we've got our pain au chocolat. We are fueled for this journey. Oh, well, here we are at the top, Alice. That was a bit of a climb. Are you okay?
Yes, I'm good. I do that often, Jonathan. Are you okay?
I'm okay. And this, what a beautiful vista. What a beautiful view to watch the sun come up over Paris. What's your favorite part of that view?
So I just love how the morning light reflects on the Parisian gray zinc roofs and, you know, on all these clay chimney pots. Here you have just a wonderful view on the most iconic buildings of Paris, both old and new. The Louvre, the Musée d'Orsay, the Panthéon, Notre-Dame. But also you can see over there the tall glass facades of the Bibliothèque François Mitterrand.
Oh, yes.
All these like colorful tubes and structures from the Centre Pompidou down there.
Beautiful. I mean, this is a beautiful part of Paris to live, but in the heart of the tourist season, this must be a crowded place.
You're right. I used to go to Montmartre during the strict lockdown, you know, when we were permitted 20-minute walks, and it was a radically different place without tourists. A lot of Parisian people living nearby really rediscovered streets that they used to avoid because of mass tourism. So lockdown had an impact on the way Parisians reclaimed some of these public spaces. For example, neighborhood dog area was created in a park where tourists used to go in Montmartre. So now tourists are back and people have to learn how to share spaces again. Jonathan, I'd suggest we take a Vélib, which is a shared Parisian bicycle, and then we can just cycle up on the Quai de Seine to Le Marais.
Oh, what a beautiful idea. Paris by bicycle, that is a dream.
Let's do it.
So tell me, Alice, the Quai de Seine, how has it been transformed?
You know, the Seine riverbanks used to be a car highway. And a few years ago, the city of Paris fully pedestrianized sections of the riverbanks. And it's now an amazing destination for meeting up, you know, practicing outdoor sports, playing, dancing, having a picnic or an aperitif. So this has inspired other radical measures to reduce car traffic in the city. For example, with the project under discussion of the fully pedestrianized hypercenter of Paris.
It is beautiful to bring people back to the streets of a city. It transforms the place.
It is. And, you know, the pandemic has actually accelerated the creation of bike lanes in Paris, with now more than 50 kilometers of new bike lanes that were created during the confinement and the lockdown.
We're going to see some wonderful highlights of the city as we pedal along.
Yes, well, you know, the riverbanks are a UNESCO listed site, so we're going to go past the Grand Petit Palais, Concorde, Le Louvre, Notre Dame.
Alice, we're arriving in Le Marais. What a cool part of town this is.
Yes, well, let's walk through the Marais. You know, it's a very dense and busy neighborhood, as you can see. Le Marais is also a historically gay neighborhood in Paris. It has a rich history of gay venues and activism.
Can we pop in at Le Gay Choc?
Oh, yes. Let's go to Le Gay Choc. You know, another great bakery for your list. It's a gay bakery in Le Marais, which, as you can see, creates very special baguettes and viennoiserie.
Describe that special baguette to me.
Well, I think these special baguettes, as you can see, represent intimate parts of a man's body.
Hmm. Very crusty.
Are
however.
You going to have one? Are you going to have one?
I think I could manage that. Alice, thank you so much. What a wonderful additions to my bread tour of this wonderful city, from the Pain au Choc to the rather distinctive baguette of Gay Choc in Le Marais.
Jonathan, that was wonderful. Now, I really better get back to work. So don't forget to actually check out the Lebanese flatbread stalls in Paris. They're amazing.
Great idea, Alice. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hope to see you again soon in Paris.
Oh, me too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The baguette is an indispensable part of Parisian life. It's a symbol of French identity, of the good life. It's much more than a cliché. The French eat 320 baguettes every second. That's 10 billion a year. I'm searching for the intersection of bread and philosophy across music, art and literature to understand bread's influence on everyday life in this city. And following my nose, I'm here at my next stop. Sage by Alain Giam, a takeaway counter, serves Middle Eastern flatbreads right here in Paris. And it's very busy.
Bonjour, je voudrais un de vos pains, s'il vous plaît.
Is that a slight hint of Australian accent I detect?
Yeah, it is. My name's Oliver Feltham. I came from Australia 20 years ago, and I'm now a professor of philosophy at the American University of Paris. I actually did a PhD in French philosophy, and I was enrolled at Deakin University, just outside Melbourne, and came to Paris when I was doing the PhD. What brings you to Paris?
Well, I'm on a trail, a bread trail. I'm following my nose and touring the bakeries of Paris, and here at Sage by Alain Guillaume. That flatbread that you've just ordered, I want to try that.
Well, it's pretty unusual flatbread because, of course, there's no yeast in it. And most French bread is all about the yeast.
Yes. You know. Now, Professor of Philosophy, Oliver, I wonder, the role of the baguette in Parisian philosophy, What's the sense of that?
Well, I would say it's very simple. In a very kind of material and down-to-earth manner, it enables the poor student of philosophy to continue to live in Paris and attend philosophy seminars because you can simply afford to eat and afford to live. I couldn't afford a croissant or a pain au chocolat when I was a postgraduate student. I just used to eat baguettes all the time because they were slightly cheaper than a croissant, but they would fill you for at least half a day. Mm.
Thus enabling the life of the mind.
That's right, it was that simple.
And the baguette in art and literature?
You can find lots of still lifes with, say, a jug of wine and a baguette on a wooden kitchen table as the kind of perfect illustration of everyday life. So it's like a symbol. And it's not just everyday life, it's also the good life. Because everybody knows how good, you know, a baguette tastes. And if you've got a bottle of red wine and a baguette, you're primed to go for a picnic on the Canal Saint-Martin, for example, or in the park Le Bouchemont. You'll find literally tens of thousands of people picnicking on a Sunday evening just with a round of camembert, a baguette, and maybe some salami and a knife. And that's their picnic.
We've just bought a flatbread and we're talking about baguettes. Between those two things, is there a story there of the shifting demography of the city?
There is. It's a funny story. It's quite complicated because on the one hand, you've had waves of immigration whenever there was a shortage of labor in France. Many, many workers came over from former French colonies, such as Algeria, for example, and some of the sub-Saharan African countries. The French have this terrible term, integration, with regard to immigrants. Immigrants are required to integrate into the dominant French culture. Mm. And there has never been any kind of official governmental recognition of multiculturalism as a policy or an attitude. And as a result, you haven't had the same kind of upward mobility for various immigrants who came over to work originally. Where you do have rich immigrants, it's people who are using Paris as their playground. So, you know, Russian oligarchs, American diplomats and their husbands or wives. Everybody from the Gulf states will have, you know, a fancy apartment in Paris. And that's a totally different story. But on the other hand, with regard to food, you'll have various neighborhoods that specialize. So there are three different Chinatowns, for example. But I still haven't found a decent yum cha in Paris, unfortunately. It's very irritating.
But there we have it, though, that the flatbread, an act of cultural defiance. And yet I suspect it is still the baguette that comes to define the dominant culture of the city.
Well, that's what you have for lunch. That's what everybody has for lunch. You have, and you can have various fancy fillings, but in the end, it's always, you know, a fresh baguette that is the staple for everybody.
Oliver, thank you. This has been an instructive and delightful walk. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is a city of more than 2 million people and 1,200 bakeries. It's the frequency with which one comes across a baker, never mind the quality and slowly evolving nature of their offering. That tells us so much about this city. The baking of bread and its constant proximity. These are fundamentals of Parisian culture, a symbol of a good life, a staple that nourishes the life of the mind, the very soul. The crusty bedrock of a food culture that prizes constancy and simple perfection. Let's not forget the price of bread was fixed in France until the end of 1986, and the ingredients of a baguette, flour, salt, water, yeast, remain set by law. So, what is it, Paris? City of light or city of loaves? 94% of Parisians live less than 5 minutes from a bakery. So, maybe there's your answer. You've been listening to Return Ticket, this time travelling Paris by baguette. You heard from Stephen Kaplan, Alice Cabaret and Oliver Feltham. Producers are Hayley Crane and Alan Whedon. Technical production and musical theme by Brendan O'Neill. Executive producer, Rhiannon Brown. Like the podcast? Tell your friends. Until next time, I'm Jonathan Green.